Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello there, listener. Progressive Britain podcast host Stefan Rolnick here, coming to you from Labour Party conference in Brighton. We've got a bumper episode for you this week. It's our 100th episode, so I sat down with Alison and Patrick Maguire from The New Statesman in a cafe around the corner from Conference Hall to talk about how politics has changed since we started the podcast 2 years ago. And earlier in the day, I ran into old Progress digital whiz Joe Cox, who was in the same bar Brighton early to watch the Welsh rugby game. We sat down in a very empty beer garden to catch up about what he's been doing since he left Progress at Hope Not Hate. In both venues, there is a fair bit of background noise. Finding space to record at party conference is not simple or easy, but hopefully you'll feel like you're right there with us. As usual, if you get any value from this podcast, and we'd really appreciate you leaving a rating and a review, it bumps us up the algorithm so more progressives like you can hear it. So without further ado, here is the 100th episode of the Progressive Britain podcast. Hello and welcome to the 100th episode of the Progressive Britain podcast, the podcast that, of course, believes that progressive politics can change the world. We've just got a 100th birthday letter from the Queen and we're sitting here in the cafe underneath the big I360 tower in Brighton, which is basically like the London Eye, but on a massive pole. And we're looking out onto the stormy Brighton Sea. And off the back of quite a turbulent few days at party conference, so we're going to ride out the peaks and troughs of party conference, but also the last couple of years in politics since the podcast was set up. Joined here by Patrick Maguire from The New Statesman. Patrick, how are you doing?
I'm very well. Slightly hungover. Sorry.
It's a pretty evergreen.
It's a family podcast, but I'm sure.
I mean, it's not really, to be honest.
My mum, I'm not sure she knows what podcast is, so I don't feel ashamed, Sam. Slightly hungover after a great Progress reception last night.
Yeah, it was good to see you. And Alison, how are you doing?
I'm absolutely fine. I went to bed quite early.
Yeah, same.
So, you know, some of us have got a job to do, eh?
Straight to McDonald's, 20 nuggets for me and straight to bed. Can we clear something up for our listeners, almost all of whom I imagine are following you on Twitter, Alison, apart from, for the three who aren't, it's at Alison_McGovern.
Correct.
A photo surfaced of you yesterday at a conference fringe event in the football kit.
Oh, goodness me, yes.
Tell us about that.
So what happened was that I was playing in the Women Member of Parliament and Lobby Journalists first ever football match every year since like Neil Kinnock was a small child. Every year there's been a men MPs football game versus the Lobby, the political journalists who work in Westminster. And for many years, on a Saturday, they would have that football game. And it will be women's conference at the same time at the Labour Party. And I will allow you to gamble which of those two events used to make it into the newspapers. And it wasn't Labour Party women's conference, yep. Put it that way. So partly because we have a women's football team now in Parliament, which is very good. Us and the women journalists decided not to play each other, but rather to be, because we're in a joint team, so it'd be weird then to play each other. So we decided that we would play Lewis FC, local football team. And we were doing that and the game overran, basically kicked off a bit late. So I didn't quite make it to my fringe event in time to get changed out my kit. And I was like, well, screw this. I'll just do it in my kit.
Still have boots on.
I did still have boots on. Yeah.
Shin pads.
Yeah, we were playing on a like 3G pitch. So it wasn't like full studs. So it's just molded, you know.
Nice. Okay.
So it was fine.
The game went well.
To be fair to Labour activists at the fringe, I don't think they noticed.
And Patrick, how has conference been for you? Because in my mind, the cliche of the journalist at party conference is 2 a.m. with an old fashioned at the back of a swanky bar on your laptop. Is it like that, or is it more like the kind of the way we do it at Progress, which is a pack of mini rolls at midnight watching the news?
God, I've not had mini rolls for years. So I'll go straight to Tesco afterwards and buy a packet.
Underrated snack.
Well, this is my third conference season as a working journalist, and at a lesser conference that immediately preceded this one, I did something I've never done before, which is I went to the hotel bar at 11 o'clock after dinner, looked around and thought, you know what, there's nothing for me here. Whereas usually I would go and have, you know, several drinks, stumble back to my room, you know, having had several conversations that I can't quite remember and business cards of people who I don't recognize and will never speak to again. So, but I mean, that is a useful and necessary part of conferences, is that sort of late night schmoozing. So I would say, you know, an old fashioned is far too classy for me, but I think you're not too far from the
truth. But it is actually a useful part of your work for you, is meeting these people.
Ultimately, you know, there are lots of people who you intend to hook up with. I mean that in a purely platonic sense of the word.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm not sure this is like the most inclusive description that we've ever given of conference on the Progress podcast.
That you mean to catch up with over the course of the year, and you don't. So it's a good time to sort of, you know, collar them and also meet people who you've never spoken to before and otherwise wouldn't have the same. You know, it's a great leveler conference. Yeah. Everybody's in the conference bar at 2 a.m. Well, not everybody. Wise people aren't.
And last night at conference, a little bit before then, we had the Progress Rally, Alison.
We did.
You opened with a speech that was actually about looking back and learning from our history. Is there, looking back at Labour Party history and British political history, what era is feeling particularly relevant for you right now?
Do you know, that's a really interesting question. And I guess I always previously would have said the 1970s because the whole European issue and the way that dominated. And it's like, okay, well, where did the Labour Party get to in the end, folks? And that was probably the right decision. But I think that this a little bit at the moment feels to me a bit more like the late 80s, in that I am old enough to remember when Margaret Thatcher resigned. And that feeling that actually the Tories were crumbling. But the lesson for me is that when I was like in finishing primary school, it felt like everything was about to change, but it didn't until I was like nearly an adult. And that we have to take the right choices, otherwise we will be out of office. You know, we've done 9 years, you know, do we want to do another nine? Like, because I don't. So we have to take the right choices.
I think it's quite a difficult thing to do, to pinpoint that exact decade. I'm reminded of the interview we did with Tim Dixon, who was a co-founder of More in Common, the charity that works at reducing polarization and working on research around social fracturing. And we had a really interesting conversation. And the way he described it was, he feels like we're kind of at the beginning of a moment. If we zoom out of Labour Party history and look at British political history, he said he got the feeling we're in like a 1910, 1920s moment. Obviously, that is fraught with difficulty. But Patrick, where do you feel like we sit right now?
I mean, I'd hesitate to put a date on it, but I definitely would agree with Mr. Dixon's basic analysis, which is, it does feel like the old drivers of voting behaviour are definitely changing. You know, much smarter people than me have written on length on this, but, you know, that question of culture and education driving voting behaviour as much as economics, I don't think there's any grounds to dispute that. And I think the most interesting bit of the speech John McDonnell just gave, you know, he was talking about all these sweeping structural reforms, but really, like, the most important bit was the paragraph, you know, the 20 or so words where he nodded almost, you know, shamefacedly to the fact he, you know, Labour needs to become a Remain party. Obviously, you wouldn't be so insubordinate as to put it in those, slightly cheeky terms. Yeah. But, you know, ultimately, regardless of the economic programme, the real question is, where do you stand on these fundamental questions of identity?
And well, let's talk about Brexit, because Alison, this podcast was set up about a year on from the European Union referendum. What do you feel like we've learned about our country since then?
Well, I think we've learned that people in the Labour Party are really quite pro-European. And I think we've sort of tested the theory to destruction that actually that there's a Labour form of Brexit that we would like and be enthusiastic about. You know, I was perfectly happy to think that there might be a compromise that we might put up with, but I think that we've learned that the internationalism in our movement is pretty strong and robust. What I think we've learned about Britain is, I don't know. I think that's still, I think that's still an open question. Yeah. I think the one thing that I'm really cross about that still goes on, and I think we're only just beginning to get to the end of, is this, like, it was Northern Leave voters that did this, you know, that actually this revealed something about, like, Northerners, that they were really unhappy with, like, globalization and all these, like, foreigners and everything. It's like Northerners who are grumpy about all of that. And they're like, no, the Brexit vote would not have happened without the people of Hampshire. Can we all just remember
that? Yeah, exactly. You never see
news crews.
And
so I think we've got a way to go on that.
You never see news crews go on safari to Sevenoaks, which is, like, you know, voted Leave by
and that place is wild, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
And I mean, one of the things that always makes me cringe a little bit in this debate, which I think is something that's been said more and more over the last few years, which is, I don't feel like I recognize my country anymore. And I think that's fraught with difficulty because the kind of the levels of polarization and kind of racism and xenophobia, actually a lot of people do recognize. And I think it's painful to admit this, but it's kind of a fundamental part of our country's recent history. And I wonder, Patrick, to what extent do you feel like this Brexit debate goes back to a bigger kind of identity crisis in British culture and British history, that, you know, that for years working class people in this country were convinced that patriotism meant signing up to the elites going around the world and plundering various different countries? And is it too optimistic to think that maybe this identity crisis provides progressive people with a chance to kind of reshape that history and have a kind of more progressive patriotism?
I'd say it's certainly worth a try. But yeah, clearly the roots of this run very deep, right? It's as much a question about the structure of the economy as it is a question of identity, right? It has as much to do with PC gone mad.
Yeah.
I would say actually maybe more to do with PC gone mad, in inverted commas, than it does, you know, deindustrialization in the north, right? It's, you know, the best line I've ever read about this is, it's not poor voters who won Brexit, it's voters who felt insufficiently rich, you know, people for whom they think life, they should win life 5-0, but actually are only winning 3-1. And so they had that desire to kick against something was born out of that. And that's where, you know, your Brexit voters in Sevenoaks come from, really.
And a fundamental part of that has been a kind of cultural polarization. Patrick, what's it been like for you to cover that as a journalist?
At times dispiriting, especially, yeah. I mean, especially in Westminster, it can be very, very depressing to just the sheer levels of disingenuousness on both front benches, actually, on these important and fundamental questions. But yeah, but it's also been like, you know, there's the terrible, dreary old cliche, never been a better time to be a journalist. So I mean, it's incredibly exciting to cover this moment of realignment, but it's also, you've got to remember, this is a country we all have to live in. And, you know, sometimes I wish I was, you know, a foreign correspondent being paid in dollars, my salary appreciating every month, but, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the bits of that drama has been the proroguing of Parliament. And there's a lot of people who've talked about in the language of a coup, and you can debate the merits of whether it's useful to talk about in that sense. But I think it almost distracts from kind of a bigger problem in British democracy right now, which is, it seems like incredibly fertile ground for democratic backsliding. You've got huge polarization. You've got a kind of stagnant economy, which with a recession on its way, you've kind of got these cultural dividing lines. And Alison, I don't want to ask you, should we be worried? Because I'm sick of asking that question, because it just makes everybody feel very despondent.
And the answer is yes, because things can always get worse. I mean,
absolutely,
that's what we found out, right? Things can always get worse.
Focusing on not necessarily even the positives, but in a very realistic sense, what it looks like to fight back against this. Kind of, how do we shift the idea of democracy as something you do in your county hall, you know, once every couple of years, to an active thing that we're constantly participating in?
So I think that Patrick's right in that I think the institutions that we have in politics at the moment are not being cared for very well by the people in them. And whether that is the Labour Party spending a lot of time sniping at each other rather than thinking about the behaviours that we all exhibit and whether or not that furthers the institution that we all proclaim to care about, or whether it is the House of Commons where, like, to be honest, the behaviours of the people inside the House of Commons. And I mean, it pains me to hear Patrick talk about people being disingenuous. For me, in politics, you have to say what you think to be right and you have to act that way. Otherwise, you put at risk the health of the institution. And when, you know, the issue that's in the Supreme Court at the moment, right, in one sense, that's a process thing. Mm. It's about how the Prime Minister did what he did in prorogation, not, you know, Brexit or the substance of the economic matter before us. However, it does matter, because if we are negligent in the state and the health of the House of Commons as an institution, then either we've got a better one,
yeah,
or we have to recognise the damage that we ourselves are doing. So I think that it is, in some ways, the time is ripe for us to set out some new ground rules. And I think with the election of a new speaker, that's what we will be doing. And I think also that when it comes, you know, the House of Commons, right, is something that we can all criticise, and it is easy copy for anybody to be like, oh, the House of Commons is the problem, party politics is the problem. However, I tell you this, I was elected in the kind of under the shadow of the expenses scandal, and you felt the responsibility to try and make it better because of that. And in many ways, it's felt to me like the past few weeks have been like the anti-expenses, in that I've had constituents coming up to me saying, I want you to go to the House of Commons and I want you to go and do that job and represent us. It's not like they like MPs anymore or they respect them anymore, but they want us to do our jobs, and we have to show ourselves to be worthy of that.
Yeah. And sort of as a broadly sympathetic observer, this is a challenge as much as it is an opportunity for progressives, right, to seize the moment and instigate the institutional change that is necessary. But the thing that strikes me is nobody votes for, to pick up on John McDonnell's speech again, you know, ultimately with the best will in the world, nobody votes for structural change. You vote for people because they have a set of answers to a moment, right? You know, nobody voted for David. Well, there might have been some people. I'm not sure I ever want to meet them who voted for David Cameron in 2010 because he was proposing elected police and crime commissioners. That's part of a wider story, right? You know, nobody voted for Blair because they wanted a Supreme Court. Mm. I suppose devolution might be the exception to that rule. But anyway, you know, it's about having a broader story to tell.
Yeah.
And you know, institutional change, it can be the undertow of that.
And I think looking at that broader story, it's quite interesting you're talking about where the cause of this and where we're tracing it back. And you mentioned PC gone mad. And I think actually the expenses scandal in many ways feels like it's, when we look back on history, it will be an important stepping stone.
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure that that's right, actually. I think the PC gone mad thing is much more deep rooted than that.
Yeah.
So the thing that unites Brexit voters, much more than where they live, what they do, their levels of education, is that they agree with the following statement, that feminism has gone too far.
Yeah.
They also are united by the idea that multiculturalism has gone too far. Mm-hmm. So we are talking about a very deep-seated view about who should have power in our country and whether it is right or wrong that we take on historic injustices. Now, I'm not going to change my mind on feminism in order to appeal to Brexit voters. So we have to recognise the political situation that we're in and work out how to win against that background. And those big changes in our society, they do have people who will disagree with them for some time. And that is just a challenge that the Labour Party has to fight now and has always had to fight.
So what does it look like to recognise a political situation and take action accordingly without compromising our values?
Well, look, that's just ask any Labour Member of Parliament who has ever stood in a marginal seat and has been greeted on the doorstep by somebody who doesn't like immigration, not because of the impact on their, you know, high street or their job, but because they don't like foreigners. I mean, what does a Labour person say to that? And I think you have to answer honestly and say, I've listened to you and I don't agree. And as it happens, Stefan, by the way, I would say my experience is that with the voters, honesty is the best policy sometimes. Yeah. And sometimes people will vote for you, not because they agree with you, but because they think that you're a decent person who's prepared to say what they think.
And so talking about another one of the policy areas where these cultural divides kind of comes through it, since we started this podcast, actually climate change activism has entered a kind of new phase of enthusiasm. And I saw somebody remark the other day that actually the climate change debate has seen children behaving like leaders and leaders behaving like children. We've all seen the awful things that various men in the media have said about people like Greta Thunberg and in response to her kind of activism. Does it look like climate change is going to be another one of those areas that fractures this kind of cultural and social divide further, do you think?
Well, we saw that yesterday or the day before, or no, and indeed yesterday, purely because in the internal row here at conference over the Green New Deal, right? There are clear cultural divides, to use Labour as a microcosm for broader society, between largely young activists who care deeply about this and want to be really ambitious, and, you know, what, I don't mean this pejoratively, but other vested interests, like the leadership and the unions who have competing interests to balance, right?
That split exists actually on the left in itself.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And so, Alison, assuming that the future of socialism will essentially be defined by climate change, what does that socialism look like to you in a broader sense? Because I guess we have to kind of start with climate change and build out in the way it's going to affect all the different areas of the economy. Do you feel confident that that kind of work is being done now to plan for that?
To a certain extent, I'm always surprised that when we talk about climate change, we constantly talk about Britain as if what Britain does will have a defining impact on climate change when it won't. I mean, I think we might more helpfully talk about our foreign policy and what we're doing with global institutions and how it's going in bringing China into those global institutions.
Yeah. And I guess that's the sense in which climate change is going to define every single aspect.
It is. But I genuinely think that we are missing the point if we think that our response to climate change can stop at banning plastic bags and everybody having a reusable cup.
Yeah.
Like, that's nonsense. You know, we will not solve it that way as China opens coal-fired power stations. So I think, personally speaking, I think I see climate change much more as a foreign policy challenge. Of course, it's an economic challenge as well. And Lord knows that I think that investment in the right sort of energy technology will serve this country well, not least because of continuity of supply, much more than its impact on climate change. But it is a foreign policy challenge, in my view.
So let's talk about what's happening right now at party conference. So Patrick, you have been, you know, hurrying around, covering every aspect of it. Obviously, we're recording this on Monday. This will be coming out on Tuesday. So we don't have all the takes and takeaways, but obviously quite a lot has happened already. So just run our listeners through who might not have been keeping up with it. What are the big headlines so far and how are things shaping up for the last few days of conference?
Well, the biggest theme is the question of tension between the various component parts of what you might broadly call the Corbynite movement, right? And the weird sort of innate conservatism of the leadership on issues that are really animating activists of all hues, right? On Europe, you know, it's more fudge. You know, on the question of the deputy leadership, it was, you know, once more into the breach. Oh, wait, not really. So really, it's the question of, to come up with what I said before about, you know, speaking to and seizing a moment. This is an opportunity for Labour's progressives, right? Because if anyone's seizing the moment, it's certainly not Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour leadership. Because, you know, the story of this conference ultimately on any issue, whichever way you slice it, is basically a story of their timidity on big issues. Be that an issue that might not be, obviously isn't on the same page as progressives, say, on the internal civil war or whatever, or on issues on which there can be broad-based policy consensus like climate and Europe.
And do you think this disunity is going to cut through in any way?
You'd think so.
Yeah.
I mean, say if you're watching the 10 o'clock news or you're driving to work and, you know, the Labour story you will hear on the music radio or we'll see at the top of the 10 o'clock news will be fighting like ferrets in a sack. It won't be bold policy offer. It will be more, you know, internal row over Brexit policy that you just want to never hear about again. So it'll certainly cut through.
And what's your take been, Alison, from conference so far?
Well, I mean, I thought I was going to go to the Progress rally on Sunday absolutely furious with forces, you know, in and around the NEC for disrupting our ability to get our message across. But by that point, it all sort of becomes slightly humorous with like people in momentum, like condemning John Lansman. And so I was like, you know, it's like us, Progress and momentum, we're all kind of like on the same side. It was like slightly bizarre turn of events. So I think it has been, you know, it's not good if our ability to communicate a message is overshadowed. That is not a success. In the end, I think that if you look at the social care stuff or 4-day week, which I don't think I've been to a fringe event yet where people haven't talked about 4-day week, and John McDonnell's done it again in his speech. And I think that's really, really fascinating. What's that telling us about the psyche of the British public? And I think, you know, if I was to ask my constituents if I could give them more money or more time. I mean, I think they're quite like both, right? Obviously they would. But I think loads of people haven't got enough time in their life. And the idea that the Labour Party is here to give you back more time, I think is a theme that we're going to run with. And it's, if that message is overshadowed, then that is a massive error, but because that is a really, really important message for us to carry.
So all these messages are super important because there's a potential general election on the horizon, but there's all kinds of parliamentary business and shenanigans that are going to happen before then. So Patrick, for our listeners now, what should they be looking out for as, you know, post-conference season as Parliament returns?
That's a really good question. Well, obviously, to throw that question back at you slightly, by the time this podcast comes out tomorrow, we'll know the outcome of the Supreme Court judgment on whether that advice to prorogue Parliament was lawful. So that the outcome of that or not will set very much set the tone. Let's wait for the European Council on the 18th and 19th, see if he gets a deal. Spoiler alert, I don't think so. Or if he does, you know, it'll, the numbers are still very tricky. So yeah, it's going to, this week is going to be incredibly busy. And you know, if anyone sort of vaguely politics adjacent is listening, you know, obviously cancel or leave, et cetera, for October.
Alison, what about you? What work's being done now ready to lay the ground for a smooth landing post-conference back into Parliament?
Well, I mean, I could tell you all the details of how we prepare for general elections in Wirral South, but then I think, Stefan, that would be giving all the secrets away.
We,
you know, you don't want to know how the magic happens, but I think that everybody is getting themselves ready and in that place. You know, but we have been needing to be on a general election footing for months and months and months, so it's not new.
And just to finish off, Alison, throw this question at you, surprise. But if our listeners are listening now and they want to go back and listen to one episode of the Progressive Britain podcast,
oh my goodness,
I mean, it's hard to pick one, and I'm sorry to put you on the spot.
Well, there's the one where I tell Alistair Campbell off. That's quite funny.
I was just in the room watching that recording, and I thought that was pretty
That I enjoy doing that. Yeah. If I'm honest, I think that actually the one that I really listening to one of our friends from Northern Ireland talking about campaigns there on same-sex marriage and women's reproductive rights. I think those are some of the sort of more powerful. It's actually not the ones with politicians, yeah. I think. It's the ones where we get to listen to other people talk about their campaigns.
Yeah, yeah. And I won't ask you, Patrick, what your favourite episode is, because I know you can't choose.
All of them, yeah, exactly.
But Patrick, thanks so much for joining us. It's been really good to have
you.
Alison, I'm sure you both have to rush off now. But thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Stefan.
Thank you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
So I've just bumped into old friend of Progress, ex-colleague, and more importantly, Welshman, Joe Cox.
Hello.
Joe, tell the listeners what you're up to now.
So I am currently working at a fun little organisation called Hope Not Hate, who are Britain's leading anti-fascist, anti-racist campaign. So Hope Not Hate was formed about 15 years ago, And in that 15 years, we've had a shining career in sort of fighting the far right and, you know, pushing back against some of the more extreme fringes in society. We beat the BNP in Barking and Dagenham in the noughties. And, you know, we stopped a Labour MP from being murdered by Nazi terrorists and a whole lot more.
All in a day's work. And so yeah. what are your main priorities right now?
Right now, one of our main priorities is beating the Brexit Party. So we're all about, you know, taking on Nigel Farage. We did a fringe here at Labour Party conference yesterday about beating the Brexit Party. And we've got a brand new pamphlet, which has just been brought out, which you can find on our website as well.
Put that in the show notes.
Yeah, if you could, that'd be fantastic. Yeah, and look, it's what it's all about. You know, they are he represents sort of the new big thing in our society. A no-deal Brexit would be absolutely disastrous for our society. It would create the sort of a fertile breeding ground for the far right to sort of redirect people's anger, and anything we can do to stop that is important.
And you're here at Labour Party conference. Listen, if you can hear a buzzing in the background, that is a ventilation system from the walkabout in Brighton, because me and Joe are actually here about to watch the rugby, but we'll get onto that in a bit.
Yeah.
But what are you doing here at conference? What's the setup?
So we've got a stall where we're sort of set up so that we can chat to people. So this is
coming out on Tuesday. So if you're at party conference, you might still have time to catch Joe on the stall.
Yeah, we're leaving Wednesday afternoon, so you'll have a couple of hours left to come and get us. We've got some leaflets. We're selling some merchandise. We've got some good t-shirts, some
those
mugs
t-shirts
and that
look
sort of
so
thing.
Good.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of them around.
I mean, this is off the podcast, but can you say one for
well,
me?
Well, you know, we'll have to see.
Friends in high places.
Friends in high places. But we're also doing a couple of fringe events. We've got an event with you guys tonight where we're doing a screening of a film that we produced recently about one of our operatives who went undercover in the international alt-right movement. Yeah, and we're just sort of, you know, we're generally around having a good time chatting to people.
And it seems like Hope Not Hate exists in this kind of nice bubble away from Labour Party politics. But obviously Labour conference has been, you know, going completely bonkers over the last few days. I mean, what have you picked up of it? What do you make of it? What's your feeling?
Well, you know, there's sort of a lot happening, but, you know, it's kind of hard to take it all in, really, isn't it? It's a tough one. But look, one thing is clear is that, you know, Labour Party is committed to fighting the far right. And that if there is going to be a Labour government, and, you know, it's not an organisational line. I don't speak on behalf of the organisation. That's been made very clear to me. you know, it's not an organisational line. But as myself, I've been a Labour Party member for 9 years. And, you know, if Labour is going to form a government, if it's going to become the party of government, it's got to understand the threat that is the far right. And, you know, the Conservative Party is starting to become that now, in my opinion. They're adopting the rhetoric of Donald Trump. It's this sort of new populism that they're really, really embracing. And it's so important for the Labour Party to not just replicate that on the left, but to actually stand up against it and be principled and say that, you know, you can't just tell people what they want to hear and you can't just stoke up people's anger, but you've got to actually give them the real solutions.
Well, listener, I urge you to check out Hope Not Hate's work if you don't already know it, which I'm sure most of you do. And, you know, follow Joe on Twitter. Joe, what's your handle on Twitter?
It's at Joseph L. Cox.
So the rugby's about to start. Let's make some fools of ourselves right now. So Wales are about to play Georgia. First game.
Comedy Ambith.
Yes, Comedy Ambith. What's going to happen? Are we going to win?
Yeah, I reckon so. We're going to win this one. We're going to win the next one and all the ones after that. And then we're going to have the World Cup, I reckon.
Right, should we duck in and get some breakfast?
Yeah, let's do it.
Cheers, all right, Joe.
You've been listening to the Progressive Britain podcast. The music was When in the West by Blue Dot Sessions, licensed under Creative Commons, and many thanks to our fantastic and long-suffering producer, Caroline Crampton.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.